Greetings and welcome to the Fisk Community Show. We are a group of internet randos brought together by a shared appreciation for lively discussion, considerate disagreements, and irreverent humor. Follow us on Twitter at Fifth Community. Find fellow seditionists by using the hashtag Fifthdom, and follow the Fifthdom Club on Clubhouse. And as always, in the words of Camille Foster, be brave, call bullshit.
Yeah, we're here. Welcome to the Fifth Column Community Podcast Show. It's me and Adrian talking about the Russian show, shit show, disaster, Ukraine ass whipping that's been happening in the last month. I'm just going to go straight into it because there's a first part to this. And if you haven't listened to it, go to that. It's me, Ben Price, you might have listened to before, and Adrian Bonenberger, who you hopefully listened to before because he called everything right. The only thing he missed was Odessa. And even then, it's not that much of a miss because it's not like they left it entirely alone. But there we go. So, Adrian, what do you think so far, man?
I mean, it's hard to know. First of all, thanks for having me back on the show. Good to hang out with you again. Yeah, it's a funny feeling saying basically like, I told you so. I feel like, I mean, but you go to Ukraine and, you know, I saw their military. Their military was in, you know, really good shape when I saw it. When I lived there, you know, people were serious about it. They had a real bitter taste in their mouth from 2014. And I think they, you know, they were getting ready for this day in a way that I didn't even understand at that time. At the time I was over there, I was sort of like, well, Russia got what it wanted. It's probably done. And they were like, no, you have no idea. You know, Russia's never done. So they've been getting ready and I knew that they were going to put up a fight. And I knew that Russia was going in kind of light for what Russia said they wanted to do. But I think everybody's been pretty astonished at how well they've performed. Granted, they have gotten, you know, a fair bit of assistance from the West. But you know, that's equipment. You still need people to pull the triggers and shoot the equipment, you know, shoot the guns and whatnot. And there have been other countries where we've given folks a lot of equipment and folks haven't been pulling the triggers so much. So it's really cool to see the Ukrainians standing up and fighting for their country.
Yeah, I mean, hard not to. Yeah, I went back and re-listened to our other podcast just to see if where the big inaccuracies were. I was wrong because I couldn't imagine they'd be fucking dumb enough to invade at the end of February. Just can't imagine. You know, why would I think that, right? Like, okay, yeah. You know, I thought they would have done it around now, maybe a couple weeks ago. But yeah, so folks, I was wrong. I gave them way more credit than they needed to. Other than that, we kind of hit it right. And I would, like you're talking about the West giving them assistance. I think it's fair to say the first week was just them. Just beating the shit out of the entire like Russian military. And, you know, yeah, you can say that the Russian military kicked the shit out of itself, right? Like the Hostomel airport seizure was maybe the dumbest combat action in 40 years, 50 years or so.
Real dumb.
Yeah. I mean, I've been trying to figure out where I would rank the stupid here. And here's my ranking, Adrian. I'll let you kind of figure out where you want to go with it. Number one with the bullet was going in and digging in around, I had a whole brain fart. The nuclear power plant that
exploded. Oh, yeah, Chernobyl. That's got to be. That's got to be the top.
That to me is number one. Like, how the fuck do you do that? Like, well, that's like, yeah, no, absolutely not. Number two is probably the Hostomel airport seizure where they tried to kind of pull a U.S. fighting like us, and that's not what they do. They don't do what we do. And trying to fight the way we do was probably number two. And then, distracted by the cat now. Number three was just this disastrous three-prong assault thing that they tried to do from north, south, and then one north to south prong on the other side of the Dnieper. What, you know, that's it. I mean, what do you got? What's your ranking there? I think we both agree, number one, digging into Chernobyl was a horrible plan.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that's a good ranking of stupidity. You know, given that all of those things are incredibly stupid, and if we'd done any one of those things after World War II, you know, we'd have been, I don't know, like, it's just, there are a lot of, there are a lot of vulnerabilities or downsides to the risk averse and corporate run military system that we have, where, like, you got people two or three levels down criticizing you and saying, kind of, sir, this is dumb, you know, don't do that. Or two or three levels up being like, I don't think this is how you want to do it. And that was always sort of frustrating to me, the lack of flexibility. But then you see a military with, you know, nothing but flexibility, where apparently people were just sort of like, let's do this. We're going to do it this way. And everyone else was like, sure, whatever, man. I mean, that, like you were saying, that multi-prong access, like, shit, like, you don't want to do that with a military that, you only want to do that with a military that has been training, like, division level interoperability for years. But, you know, like, that's something that the Germans didn't even try in World War II until, like, a couple of years in. Like, they didn't do that stuff until they were fighting the Russians, and it worked really well against the Russians. You know, it didn't work that well against the Poles or the French. The French and the Poles kind of, you know, did it to themselves a little bit. With the Poles, it wasn't really their fault anyway, because, you know, they were fighting a two-front war against Nazi Germany and the USSR. But that stuff's really hard, man. It's really hard to pull off. And it's like, look, if you want to set yourself up for success, just do something really simple. And they wanted Odessa, and they wanted Kyiv, and they wanted the East. And they also didn't seem to think that they were going to fight at all, like, for the first week. They were like,
that, yeah, crazy. Yeah, I mean, but at least, like, this is why I ranked the Chernobyl thing number one, is because no matter how you cut it, you're just digging into irradiated dirt. There's period. The Hostrovo thing ends up number two because they had deluded themselves with the false sense of, like, oh, you know, we have some assets in some parts of the Ukrainian military. They're going to help us out, especially down south by Crimea. But the idea that Ukraine was just going to fold, it seems to be based into, like, that seemed to be baked into what they were just planning to do. And it clearly did not work that way. So, yeah. I mean, you can delude yourself. So that's kind of it. It's just, yeah, man. So I guess, I mean, I just think about it like this. Like, so, okay, so that was the first week. And then basically the Russians spent, like, another week and a half trying to keep making their first plan happen, right? Would you call it like that? Trying to keep, like, we'll just keep attacking the same three axes and it'll work. And it, of course, didn't work. And then we, you know, so that's it. 2.5 weeks in, we've been at it for about a month and a half. So then they realized, okay, it's not going to work that way. They spent a week with people in kinetic activity figuring out what they were going to do next. So now we're at week four. And then week five, they started their reorganization pullout thing where they're talking about extending, which is never good, right? We need to extend conscriptions. We need to try to bring more people in, all of this stuff. And in that time, I mean, I don't know how, like, people are freaking out about the number of generals that are dead. And I'm here to tell you, like, there's more generals in the Russian military. It's not like the American military where, like, a general is at a really high level. It's like, no, man, like, they push them down to, like, brigade, what we would call a brigade. Sometimes even if they've been bad, you know, battalion level, they don't. And there's just more of them. It's a very centralized kind of authoritarian thing. We heard reports of them, like, driving over a general. Did you hear about that? Do you think that's accurate? You think that's accurate?
Was it a general or a colonel? I don't remember which.
It was a general. It was like someone's
general.
Yeah, some one star. Their men fragged him by driving over him with a tank. Reporting?
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's not all that surprising, is it? Like, it's definitely within the realm of possibility. I mean, there are photos of, like, an injured dude, and people were like, yeah, that's the guy. He's the guy who got run over. There was reporting done on the guy who ran over him, who apparently had been, like, in a lot of fighting and, like, had some sort of motivation to do it. Who knows? I wasn't there. But, yeah, I mean, I imagine there's a lot of tankers in the Russian army right now who aren't too happy with their leadership.
Well, I mean, yeah, to say the least, like talk about just bad decisions left and right. So that only brings us to like 6 weeks in. The Russians seem to have given up on the entirety of the western half of the Dnieper River, all of it. They have launched some nonsense stuff at Lviv, but clearly nonsense stuff. No one thinks it's serious. They lost one of their last warships to a place without a navy. And they're focusing all of their effort basically on Black Sea real estate gathering, which I'm sure to the average Russian soldier is something you really want to be there for. I'm sure the Black Sea estates that you will never get to be a part of are like on your list of things to work for. So I guess my question now is, there's supposedly something about the May Day, Victory Day, which is the commemoration of Stalingrad, right? That's kind of the thing. That's where it originates from. So is that just bullshit that we're telling ourselves that it's going to end then? Or do you think it's going to keep going for a while until basically some kind of half-assed armistice is signed? And then is it really going to be over? Or are we going to be back to like the pre-invasion state where clearly the Russians want more?
Yeah. Well, to begin with, that all that stuff about like reorganizing and recocking, you know, I think you look back at your own, I look back at my time in the military. I don't know if you look back at your time in the military and think through like what we did. You were in 191, right?
No, I was in Delta Company.
You were in Decal. I'm sorry. Yeah.
All right.
Oh, you were in Decal.
Well, that's when you knew me. I was in Lurs before that. So that was kind of, that's how I knew Collins and all that. So yeah.
You know what? So that's why the reason I had you on 191 was because I had the Humvees and the kind of like the mobile. So you were the deco was the kind of 191 of the 1503rd. It was the weapons company.
Yeah.
And, so you came in, I mean, like you remember we were training up for Iraq and then we had to like pivot with like a month, 2 months before we left.
Yeah.
And we went to Afghanistan instead. And it's like very different train up. You think to yourself, like, that's like 173rd, pretty good unit. You know, we had assets, but we did Grafenwehr for Iraq. And then we ended up doing Hohenfels, I think for Afghanistan.
For Afghanistan. Yeah. And then there was, we were in Winterfell for like some other thing, which was Iraq training. We were doing CQC and all that stuff. So, you know, you never do any of that for Afghanistan because you were never going to be the door kicker there.
Right. That's right. Right. So, yeah. So there's all this stuff, you know, and I think to myself, like, man, we were a battalion, you know, like we were training companies to sort of coordinate with each other. You can assign a battalion to like a tactical task and say, okay, guys, you're going to be driving around in the streets and then say, oh, actually it's going to be hiking in mountains. So you guys should like put in a couple months of hiking or whatever. Like it's kind of tough. And like, we lost a lot of time. We wasted a lot of time doing shit that we probably would have done differently if we'd known from the jump we were going to.
I mean, we were doing Arabic language training. So that would be the first thing. That was a couple of weeks. We would have absolutely ex-nated that.
Exactly. And so I think about like, a whole ass army is changing their strategy. A whole fucking army that doesn't know how to fight combined arms. Just like, oh, actually we're going to do it this way instead. And I'm like, I don't think Russia has changed in 2 months. I think dudes have probably gotten better at fighting. I think guys have had more gun time and more time in their tanks, but like, you don't just go from, oh, I'm going to do like, a bunch of different axes of advance and there's going to be tanks over here and mechanized infantry to like, oh, we're going to do this other thing now that we haven't trained on, or you don't train up for it like in a couple of weeks. Like it's the other point that I want to make here really quickly is the Ukrainians have been training for the Russians to do what the Russians are doing badly right now for 8 years. The Ukrainians have been training for this exact eventuality, which is their worst nightmare. I don't think it's going to go if, you know, I don't think this is something that the Russians can kind of, cover for with more troops. If they mobilize another 100,000 or 200,000 conscripts and slam AK-47s and ammo in their hands, I still don't think it's going to, like, I just don't see them doing well the way they want to do, which goes to your second point about, you know, 2 to 3 weeks from now, which is this, you know, May Day celebration. I think it's tied to the end of World War II. It's the victory over the Nazis. And, yeah. And I just, like, I don't see it. I mean, it's every time Russia does something big like this, like they've kicked off a bit, like, big movements, big muscle movements in the East. Like, what they're really doing is they're signing on to get their asses whooped, you know, because they don't.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not looking good. Yeah.
In present time. I don't mean a year from now or 5 years from now, like when they've had time to train or whatever else. I mean, right now, them doing something different is just them getting their asses handed to them again. They're going to go far into Ukraine's east. They're going to overextend their supply lines again. Ukraine is going to bend like they did before, and then they're going to start encircling. And the Russians, once again, are going to be lucky if they're able to get out of the pockets before Ukraine shuts the door on them. And then, I don't know. Yeah, is Russia going to say, Kherson is part of us now? I mean, like, who are they negotiating with? Like, Ukraine isn't going to go for that. Ukraine's not going to say, yeah, Kherson is on the table. Ukraine isn't going to say, yeah, okay, your Mariupol is yours now. I think the fighting's going to continue. Until the Russian military collapses.
All right, that's a bold prediction. All right, I mean, it's something on the list of possibilities of them of just exhausting to the point where they can't maintain any kind of kinetic effort, sustain any kind of kinetic effort at all. I think, you know, so that was the second question. It was like, is May bullshit? I think we kind of agree. May is kind of a bullshit, made up thing that is what. It'd be nice. It'd be great to kind of get this over with. For a lot of people, not the Ukrainians, they're not going to like how this ends. That's my thing. The more I kind of look at this, I'm like, this seems a lot like the Finnish Winter War, although maybe the Ukrainians come out with a better deal at the end than the Finns got. But I guess I would say this. It looks more like people read about the Finnish War and they go, oh my God, they crushed the Russians. They beat the shit out of them. They absolutely did, but they lost. Like, they paid a war indemnity. They lost 62,000 people in a population of 3 million. The only thing they got to keep was their basic sovereignty, and that was it. And that was what they were fighting for. So that was the limited war aim they could tolerate. But then they spent forever being basically beholden to Soviet interests and were very scared of ever engaging the Russians again. And I'm just saying that's just the – I think that's the metric to compare to. The difference, though, is the Ukrainians are doing so much better than they did. I suspect that they'll get a better deal out of it, but I do think they're going to – I mean, in fact, the U.S. has told them in writing, we're going to give them – we'll recognize Crimea. We'll recognize these separatist spots, which only makes this – it's fucking weird to think about, but it's really a 21st century technology fighting a 19th century European land war over limited dirt. It's really what it boils down to. And that's the kind of stuff that's like the guns go silent audio recording thing where, like, you can listen to World War One literally end like in silence. And that's just nuts to me to think about it like that. So we get them to this. So I guess the question is, what do you think? All summer? You think we're going to have all summer fighting?
No, I don't. I think, I mean, Russia still wants to fight. Here are the variables as I see them. Ukraine has, according to the Pentagon briefing yesterday, they've got something like 25,000 anti-air pieces between man pads, missiles for their, you know, S-300s, old-ass, you know, Vietnam or Korean War era, like Zeus 23s, like all told, 25,000 either rockets, missiles, or what have you. They've got...
And for the people at home that might not understand that, like, it might be old, it doesn't mean you want it flying at you. It doesn't mean that, oh, okay, we can totally defeat this technologically. It's not the same thing as like a musket ball. Like, this stuff is still, I mean, frankly, if you're unarmed and somebody's got a musket, the dude with the musket still has an edge, kind of a thing. It's the same basic concept. Like, it matters. It's just not the latest and greatest.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like if you're flying in a helicopter and you've got 50, you know, you got a couple 50 cal rounds coming at, or 50 cal machine guns, like blazing at you accurately, like that's not a good situation for you in a helicopter.
Yeah. Nope. And they do have M2s. I saw that now.
Yeah.
That's that which I was like, oh, we gave them those. All right. That's going to matter. That's going to be a big deal.
Yeah. 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 There's a lot of stuff they have now. I think they've got, probably about what they need. It sounds like there are some of the countries that are, some of their neighboring countries are also kind of, you know, fixing stuff up for them. So as close to participating actively in the war as you can get without actually putting soldiers into the war. I think Ukraine, they've got, you know, I think they got their they finished training their first tranche of like about 100,000 people. Their first set of reserves, the people who signed up for the Territorial Defense Forces a couple months ago, those people are starting, anecdotally, those people are starting to move forward, replace some of the combat losses and maybe even more. I think they've actually got a surplus. So they've been able to train more than they've lost. Ukraine has. And then they're working on the second, you know, the second group of volunteers as well. And then some people who are coming back from, or coming from, overseas to do that. So they're building combat power. Ukraine is building combat power. People are really impatient to get in the fight. Morale is really high. And then you look at the Russian side, and Russia has, you know, up between 10 and 20% of the military that they went into the country with, and it with a disproportionate amount of casualties from those formations in their best units, which they led with, including that their airborne
units. Yeah, the VDB.
Yeah. Yep. Well trained and you know pretty motivated units that could have been assigned to not an airfield isolated 20 miles away from a city
could have been an airfield outside of Kherson, right? That would have made more sense. Like we can logistically get to you within 2 days, not abandon you because we have contested air. Which to me, I mean that I think is going to be the TTPs they've employed to keep their air power. It's reminiscent to me of how the English used air against the Nazis, just really moving them around fields, roads, very innovative like things to keep their air, like don't risk it all in a full combat. It's not worth it. We need to fight where we're going to win. Use the try to keep the odds in as best shape as we can. Do not overcommit to any one engagement. Just very, very smart stuff. And now I guess they're getting more planes. And if you're Russia, that the contested air has been the bane of your existence. So I don't know. I get what I think what the Russians want to do is they think that they're going to artillery just flatten everything along the Black Sea. And how are they going to hold that massive line? I don't see how they'll be able to do it. And sure, they can retreat north and south, but between their inability to like effectively communicate where people are moving, they're going to get whole units like you're saying, encircled, captured, dead, something. And I do think the Russians are getting better because they're starting to realize, hey, if we're going to die here, like we will, Vladimir Putin will absolutely get us killed for this piece of shit, right? Like right, this little dirt, I will die for this little square of dirt. And he has no problem doing it. He'll sign all the death letters. He does not care one iota. It's just, that is like some, again, this is 19th century, like fighting over the dirt kind of a thing.
I think, and this is just conjecture, I don't have any evidence for this, but I think the first real piece, the first real indication we have of that exactly is that the Russian soldiers learning, not the Russian military, Russian soldiers, because saying the Russian military is learning is the same thing as like saying like, well, Russia is learning because the Russian administration is learning or something. Like I think soldiers are learning. And again, so I think like really good one piece of potential evidence for that is they called off the assault on Azovstal. They said, we're not going to take Azovstal, which is this factory in Mariupol that's like a fortress. Like it takes 5 minutes to drive by it, to drive past it. You're just driving past a giant ass factory. It's a massive fortress, essentially.
Yeah.
Fortified modern 20th century, really, you know, 1970s era fortress. And my guess is, my take on this is not that Putin said, we're not going to take that. What I think probably happened was the soldiers on the ground were like, we're not going to fucking do that. And they told the generals, and the generals had to go back to Putin and say, we can't do this, which, you know, no general wants to tell Putin. Otherwise, why would he say, we're not going to take the fortress? If they could take the fortress, he would say, we're going to do this and we're going to close out Mariupol. Somebody told him, we cannot do this. And my guess is because charging World War I style at a fortress to get schwacked, Russia would lose every single fucking soldier in Mariupol trying to take that, like Garen fucking Teed. They would lose them all. They would lose every trigger puller they have in that city right now, and they still wouldn't have it. And so the soldiers are just like, we're not going to fucking do it. We'll isolate it, but we're not going to do it. Respectfully, sir. I guarantee you those conversations happened after they lost a few hundred dudes, and they're like, we're not going to fucking do it.
I suspect that to me, the best case scenario is that they got ground up feedback saying, hey, why would we try to leverage people that are wedged between us and the water in a spot that we don't need? Like at best, it's like they got pushed back and they said, that's a good point, you know, in their Russian accent. That's a good point. Like, why would we try that when we could only lose massive amounts of people? I mean, you know, and I think I absolutely think that there's like that military chain of command in for the Russians, because it has become just, I wouldn't say shredded, but the trust is gone. I mean, there's nobody trusting anybody now. There's no way they're going to muster their men to do suicide charges against something in that situation. Because from your perspective, if you're a grunt on the ground, it's that, like I said, it's that like there's the water. Here's us. Nothing's coming between us, and they're not getting resupplied unless somebody's got a submarine that they're going to be able to like pop up and, you know, give them food and water. And I'm sure that there's a lot of Ukrainian innovation at work in that regard. But why would we do that? And they are there. Like, they won't leave. Like, you're not going to leave the defensible position. So why do it? I think that the questions I have are more like, okay, so this, it would be nice if this were to end. I understand the Ukrainians aren't going to like the deal that they're going to end up making. It's going to be a better deal, I think, than what the Finns got. To me, this is one of those things that's just going to be always in flux until it's resolved. And who's going to do the negotiating is a great question, because I don't see the Ukrainians wanting to back down one bit. I don't see Putin has no problem getting like as many people killed, it seems like, so far. So your point is like, you think the Russian military is just going to exhaust itself and fall apart?
Yeah. So, you know, you see a lot of talk on the Russian side of the house and in Russia's administration, their blogosphere, their state journalism, their state propaganda outlets. And people are like, we will fight them to the beaches. We will fight them in the mountains. We will fight them in the basements. And yet Russia is having massive problems, even getting, even paying enough contractors to backfill their losses. Like, if Russia had the stuff that they needed to do this, they would. So people are walking down the streets, waving Russian flags and saying death to Ukraine and Putin's a genius. And then when it comes time to like go sign their name on the piece of paper to go in the military, nowhere to be found. So, you know, talk is cheap. And I think like Ukraine, people are signing up. I know some people who have signed up since the war started.
I mean, it's pretty obvious from every description of Lviv that it's like, it's literally just like, if women and children are the only ones that are even in that part of Ukraine at all, it's like, or really old men or really young. Yeah. So that's it. Like, it's pretty much everybody. And that's every reporter, like Michael Tracy even concedes to the point when he's not saying stuff that I'm just like, I don't know what you're trying to do, dude, but all right. You want to be so anti-war, you're pro dictator, whatever. I can't win. But I think this kind of gets to the other thing, which is a lot of people are reaching for trying to figure out why the Russians are doing atrocities. And I wrote an article saying, hey, this is what they do. This is what they've always done. Like, there's a reason why, you know, there's audio, leaked audio. I don't know how accurate it is. So take it with that. Like, I don't know the guy, but his wife is giving him permission to rape Ukrainian women. Like, that is the Russian way of war. Cruelty is the feature. It's the idea of like, I mean, this whole thing started with like Putin basically telling the Ukrainians, you know, you do what I ask you to do, it'll be okay. You don't do it, and this is the bad stuff is going to happen. So this is the bad stuff happening. So he's and it's atrocious. It's hard. I mean, there was a video apparently going around. I did not watch it. I want nothing to do with this. Of some 8-year-old being abused. Someone described it, a guy named Vincent Artman, as like, it's basically child porn. And I'll just, and I actually know that guy from high school. So I'll just take his word for it and say that whatever, man, like that's it. Do you concur with that? Do you think that that's kind of like that? Yeah, this is how the Russians fight wars. Do you disagree? Or do you think this is like a top-down thing? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I'm not an expert on military culture. Like certainly not Russia's. It seems like a lot of bad shit happens when the Russian military is involved. But then, you know, I think about like the war criminal, you know, the one war criminal that I know of in Afghanistan, Robert Bales, you know, a dude who went out and murked 16 people, civilians, like just went off the deep end. He had a bunch of excuses for why he did it. But, you know, our answer to that was, you know, we threw him in Leavenworth where he's going to spend the rest of his life. Even Trump wouldn't pardon him.
Yeah, like, I know.
He's the guy that Trump wouldn't pardon.
Yeah, I was going to say Trump even said, I got standards.
Yeah.
I got it's a low standard, but I won't let that guy off.
I think it's like, I really think it's a discipline thing. I think we can kind of, you know, pat ourselves on the back a little bit in the sense that like, that's, you know, we weren't there to do that type of thing. And war is a weird kind of, you know, space. You got a gun and somebody starts shooting at you and you get to shoot back. And then you can do a lot of other shit from there. Like you're just like in a weird space once you're pulling the trigger. And I think like, yeah, in a military that didn't have any NCOs and the officers themselves were kind of lousy, like obviously like not too bright. And the people themselves, like the soldiers themselves are just like, didn't expect any of that stuff to happen. It doesn't feel all that surprising to me that they'd like start popping off and doing atrocities and genocide and all that shit. I mean, there's not a huge, you know, line that actually separates any of us in civilization from savagery and madness. You know, it's a few days without food and like a couple days without water and people start kind of going nuts. So I don't know. I think it's more of a broader thing. But you absolutely are right that like when the president says you have, you know, permission to go and do all of this terrible shit, then the worst people in the world, the worst people in your military are going to take full advantage of that. That's what they've been waiting to hear.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's one of those things like the Russians, it's a European thing too, the 3 days of looting for folks that want to read real deep into European history. It really didn't go away until the middle of the 20th century when Europe really just ceased fighting each other for the most part in overt big battles. But that 3-day looting thing didn't even really come under any kind of scrutiny until like the 18th century. So anyway, I don't want to befuddle but bemoan the point, but and get into the history of it and whether or not it's fair. I just want to talk about it because it brings to me this new thing, which is now we have all this video of all this stuff and facial recognition and these soldiers, like they're doing this stuff. I don't know how, like they won't be able to leave Russia, like, and maybe they're none of them were ever going to in the first place, but this is going to be very different, I would argue, going forward for the people where we have like video proof of you like committing an atrocity on the TikTok or the YouTube and everything. So here's my question. Isn't this a new aspect of war, of like the real accountability on a ground level? Or do you think this is something that'll kind of fade out over time or change? It won't change as much as I think it will.
Yeah, it's certainly a new, it's the new technology has made, I don't know that it's necessarily going to change war. It's definitely going to change how justice systems handle war crimes. And it's going to change how society views war because, to your point, as exactly as you said, you know, that dude's wife who said, you know, it was okay for him to rape Ukrainians, like, whether I think the follow-up to that was they said they were joking or something, or, but actually, like, they didn't mean that. Like, she and he aren't bad looking people. Like, they're not a bad looking couple. Presumably she would have liked to have gone to Paris someday. And like you said, you know, that's not going to happen now. Like, yeah. She, no Berlin trip. Sorry. Like, no 10th anniversary trip to Rome, like, without you getting policed up and, you know, spending some time in The Hague, best case scenario, worst case scenario, spending a lot of time. That's something, I don't know if you were thinking about this in 2007, 2008. I mean, I certainly was a little bit 2007, 2008, a lot more in 2010, 2011, just like, you know, being on Facebook, being on social media and being like, man, you know, if the Taliban had their shit together, it wouldn't be too hard to figure out who I was and sort of, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. I mean, I was in 06 when, and this is just an anecdotal story about something, but I was in Afghanistan in 06, 05, 06, OEF 6, all of the sixes, when the bodies of the Taliban got burned by Legion Company, and it made the news. I think it was August, because it was whenever Hurricane Katrina hit, and I know this because before that, they were taught, like, I was going on leave at that time, and I was in Kandahar, and I knew all these people that were involved in all this stuff. They were talking about taking Legion Company out of Afghanistan early, sending them back home way in advance, relieving, you know, all the stuff. And then Hurricane Katrina hit and washed that whole show right off the news. And ultimately, I won't name him, but the couple of guys really just kind of got their wrists slapped, and that was kind of how that went. And that was just for burning dead bodies like that. And that's let's be real, in the realm of war crimes, that's a low thing. That is not the same as like torturing someone while they're alive. It's not good, but I would put that as like way lower on the scale. And I'm using that to just kind of say, like, the war crime thing, like, yeah, it matters, but as a U.S. soldier at the time, you would have probably, and especially stationed in Italy, you never would have thought, oh, the Italian Carabinieri are going to hem me up because they got video of me being around these bodies being burned. And that didn't happen, right? There's video of it and it existed, but nobody I know ever got pulled in by the CARBs because, hey, you were on this video. We got some questions for you. That ain't the case with this kind of stuff. Like, the whoever commanded the unit at Buka is, I mean, that's the kind of stuff where people will actually like go find you in Russia and drag your ass out to face trial, kind of a thing. And I think that that actually is a new dynamic of really like being able to pinpoint, know who raped and killed your mom or your mother, or your mother. Wow, I'm just having a great time with my memory lately. And knowing who that person is, like having a name, which means you can find an address pretty easy. So that's new. That's a very new thing. And I do think that I think you're agreeing with me, but I think in the bigger sense, that's going to change not war itself, but the consequences and fallout for the folks involved. Because there will be something, especially if there isn't anything done on like the civilian side to show that there was some kind of justice that was, you know, prosecuted upon someone. The thing I'm getting concerned about with the peace stuff, and not just peace talks, but just in general how we're moving forward, is I don't know if we're giving Ukrainians enough of a say, but at the same time, I understand our own point of like, what are we going to do? Are we just going to let them fight it out forever? Like how long can we ask the Ukrainians to keep, cause this can go the other way. And ultimately if Russia does like bring all of its power to bear and really takes on its lessons learned, it would, I'd argue it would only get worse for the Ukrainians over time. So when should Ukraine pull the trigger on peace is kind of one of the questions. Honestly, I'll say it's not a high probability. In fact, I'd give it like a 5% probability, but Putin is pissed off enough and freaking me out enough that I do think like he might nuke somebody. I don't think that's beyond the pale. It's a horrible thing, but he's not been rational the whole time. So what do you think about all that, I guess?
So the first thing about the possibility, the first thing is, the Ukrainians are fighting this alone. We're giving them weapons, we're giving them ammunition, but for them, I mean, they're fighting it alone. There's no, they have no allies.
And winning.
They are winning, but right now they're the ones who are fighting it. They're fighting Russia, and Russia isn't even fighting alone because Russia's got a soft ally in Belarus, which has committed logistical support and soldiers. And they've got a notional ally in Syria and a very soft ally in Chechnya, which is part of them, but sort of like has some kind of autonomy. So Russia has more partners in this than Ukraine does. And Ukraine is, to your point, winning. A lot of people don't understand that the only thing we can do is not send them weapons and equipment, which would mean that they would take more casualties, but it wouldn't mean that they would stop fighting. Just mean that they would, fight longer and harder, and it would be bloodier. That's what that actually means. They're going to fight. This is the only, this is the most essential insight to have into the conflict, is that Ukraine, and they've done this, about a dozen times over the last 500 years, before America was around, before NATO was around. They did it with the Ottomans. They did it with Russia a few times. They did it with Sweden. They did it with Poland. They did it with Germany. They did it with Austria-Hungary. They did, pick a fucking country that's been, or an empire that's been around Ukraine, and they fought them. And they fought them for a long time. They fought them for months or years at a bite. And for the most part, they've lost. And so they themselves are ready for that. But if you're willing to lose everything and you're like, it's this important for us to do this, it's part of your DNA, then man, coming at that kind of energy, you got to be prepared for that. Russia was not, and I would say still is not. And if Russia had more to give, right now, Russia is applying their full military
Yeah, Russia is tapped right now. You're right. For their current situation. Now, yep.
All the schlitz in the can has been poured out into Ukraine, and that's what they have. It's crazy to think that, because we know they've got more planes. We know they've got a lot more tanks. We know they have a ton of people, but nobody's there doing it. How many of those fifth generation fighters work? We don't know. I mean, I think the last time we talked, I don't know if we covered this or not, but one of the big things that was astonishing in 2014 was when Russia invaded the first time, was Ukraine had on paper a military of, depending on what source you read, 40,000, 60,000, or 125,000. In actuality, they had three brigades, the 95th, the 91st, I think the 91st and the 25th, about 7,000 soldiers that had weapons, that were trained, that were competent, that trained as a unit, that were ready to do anything. I don't know what the percentage is on that, but it's not great. They had 800 tanks on paper, of which 12 worked. And those were the 12 that they used for parades. I got that from the dude who was the general who was in charge of Ukraine's armor. And they had to cannibalize parts, and they had to take, the widget from the turret off of one put it in the other one. And they ended up with 500 some odd tanks a few months into 2014, but it was all hands on deck. And so Ukraine went through that existential crisis in 2014, and they fought and they lost, as they often have, against Russia over the years, over the decades and centuries, but they learned their lessons. And so Russia going into Ukraine today, 2022, we know what they have on paper, but what we didn't know was what percentage of that stuff they had on paper was real. They got 2 million people in the army. How many of those were like the Afghans, just fucking ghost positions?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I got a unit of 1,000.
Yeah. No.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
They got 15,000 tanks. How many of those motherfuckers start on the first or second turn? It's so, to Russia's ability to put its full might in play is a description of today. That's present moment. The question about nukes is tough, because that's the only country that's ever deployed nukes in a war
is
the United States of America. And it was at the end of a very bloody war that started when we got attacked. I mean, a nuke is not something that you deploy casually. I think we deployed it in a kind of a fucked up and a racist way, that we deployed our two nukes. We didn't give a shit about what we were blowing up. One of the cities that we blew up, Nagasaki, is the Christian city in Japan. That's where like all the Christians in Japan are.
No, I mean
the Christians.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the whole dropping of the bomb is like, it's its own series of history, and anybody's ever dug into it. It is something to read about, I think, if you're an American. But yeah, we're it for drop for using them so far. I do put it as a low chance. I just don't. Putin just doesn't seem like he's in his right mind at the moment. Especially now. Now he feels backed into a corner over this.
So there are only three places that make any sense to drop a nuke anyway. Because tactically a nuke isn't going to do all that. Like Ukraine's military isn't concentrated enough for it to actually tactically create any type of effect.
I agree. Like a nuclear weapon against a dispersed military is mostly a nuclear weapon, because it wouldn't be more than one, is not going to change the tactical series on the ground unless somehow everyone's massed in one spot. So I agree with that. It's symbolic. It's pain. It goes back to, you didn't want to play ball with us, so now we're really going to hurt you in a way that you've not been hurt before. And that does seem to be kind of the way the Russians are going.
So, but if it doesn't have any tactical consequence, he drops the nuke. The only thing that's going to do is like, even the Chinese will turn on him after that. You know, like the Chinese have their own history with nukes, like, because MacArthur was talking about putting those things in play. Like nukes are the one thing that will even turn the authoritarians against fucking Putin. He will lose so much more than either a tactical or a diplomatic gain. And the other thing I would say about that is the three places where he would even consider maybe getting some type of like, symbolic effect from dropping a nuke that would severely impact Ukraine. Kyiv,
number one,
Odessa and Lviv all have incredible religious significance and spiritual significance to Rus and Russia and the myth of Russia that Putin is himself invested in. And I don't think, for this reason, I do not think he would nuke any three of those, which means if he's talking about nukes, he's probably thinking about nuking some smaller city. If he's smaller city, all he's doing is outraging people.
Yeah.
And Ukraine is just like, wow, you fucking nuked this like city.
Yeah, this the city that
we're giving up. Like now if you thought it was on before, now it's all the way on.
Yeah. Now he wouldn't I do mean this is something we're talking about just because he has nukes and he's kind of losing his mind. But I do put it, I think that actually is the red line in Russia of like, I'm going to drop a nuclear bomb. You're going to be poisoned here in the next 20 minutes. Yeah. You're going to have a heart attack and that's just what's going to happen. And that I do think is the thing. And it's not, honestly, like one insight I have for folks that are wondering what the Chinese are doing in all this. You got to remember the Chinese used to have Siberia. Siberia has not always been this Russian space. They would probably like some of those resources and was Manchuria and the eastern half of Russia back under their control someday, because they do kind of view that as a traditional piece of dirt of theirs. So they're not exactly giant like Russian supporters. A lot of people are like, why are they so frosty? I'm like, there's a long history there. It's not something that's just, oh, the communists came and patched all up and everything's fantastic. Like, that's not how it worked. It is concerning though. I think it's something we should talk about because he has proven that he is kind of losing it, whether it's sentimentality or just losing his mind. I mean, what else do you want to talk about on this? Because I think I'm out of questions at this point in time.
Yeah, the most important thing I think that I wanted to cover, and I know a lot, I know about what other folks know now at this point. You know, when we talked, I was probably one of the very few people in the world who had any, meaningful insights to share that a lot of other folks didn't have about what's going on. And, now I'm kind of like stabbing in the dark like everybody else. I don't know exactly how things are going to work out. But I think the biggest thing is just to understand and appreciate that Russia, war is hard. It's hard. Like combined arms warfare is really hard to do. We train on that shit all the time. And like, we got most of our guys fairly competent at it, but I wouldn't say we were necessarily good. Like you imagine the hundreds of, like, our unit in a, in like a long war at like not being used properly, dismounts, we're just sort of like light infantry like everybody else after the initial airfield seizure. We've probably taken, you know, somewhere between 25 and 50% casualties. And like whoever's left over can kind of like talk to planes and talk to the artillery and get everything in like place together. But like everybody can't do that. And like the Russians aren't even trying to put all those things together in the same place, yeah. You know, like,
oh my word. Yeah. It's, you know, it's painful to watch. Like,
it's crazy how sloppy it is. And for that reason, I think, and the other thing is that like just war on the offense is really difficult. War on the offense is not easy. As soon as you fucking move, you know, you and the units next to you get out of sync because you hit the checkpoint and somebody else hasn't hit their checkpoint yet because they found something in the road or because they took contact. And now, you know, you have to stay online. You kind of have to like stay synced up.
Yeah, you can't.
If you don't.
Yeah, movement's way different when you're playing offense and you have to take and control ground. It is not freedom of movement. Is a huge deal in terms of like how you're going to wage a war. And the Russians clearly didn't have that. I mean, you're talking about like, I don't know. You're right. We might do combined arms the best in terms of talk and air, in terms of like, you know, ideally, it's not how it really worked out, but ideally it wasn't just like your PL and your platoon sergeant that could talk to a bird. Like if it had to be, you know, so-and-so who's a gunner on like, you know, squad 3, they could conceivably talk to a bird and not get anybody killed, right? Do a 9-line medevac with the writing, you know, spell it out for them and things like that. The Russians clearly don't have that. They don't have that training. They did not invest in that training. And then if they did, they got so many of their guys killed now that when they do whatever they want to call out, where they basically pull in the conscripts and spread out the veterans, like, what's that going to look like? Hey, here you are. You barely survived the last round, and now you got all these guys fresh off the boat thinking that they're going to get to, you know, sleep with Ukrainian women at night and have a nice warm place to sleep. It's not going to work that way until the summer when you have at least a nice warmer place to sleep. And that's if you get to sleep. That's the thing. That is just a thing. The training difference is something that I think that we are getting onto something a little different here, but I think that's the biggest thing that's going to come out of this for the West and the world is like, why the fuck are we spending all this money to fight this? If this is the best they got with their best assets, why? Like what? We could beat this like half or a quarter of what we've been spending now. Why do we need an F-35 fighter if their best fighters couldn't handle F-15s, right? Like if we sent F-15s to Ukraine, they would be mad at us. They wouldn't think, oh, great, they're getting crappy equipment. They're like, don't give them stuff that can hurt us. Like that, you know, I mean, that's the kind of logic at play here. Like, how far back in our reserves, F-4 Phantoms? Like, here's an F-4 Phantom. Oh, yeah, you send them those. Send them those all day. Get, you know, put their pilots in those all day. Just Don't supply them F-15s or newer. That's like F-15 is what, 1971, 68? This is a second-generation fighter. It's antique in terms of what we consider in modern military, but we spent all this money on all this stuff. And now it's like, why? I think there's something there.
There's, you know, one other thing, I agree 100% with all of that. And I think that we need to take a look both at, you know, our intel, how we assess the threats, not just in terms of what they're building, but what their capacity is. We need to look at our analysis. I think a lot of the analysis that gets done of near peer, you know, very generously near peer militaries, very generously, is done by people who get paid by directly or indirectly by contract, by military, by industry, essentially by the arms industry. They're not incentivized to look accurately at what these people have. They're incentivized to inflate the threat. The other thing that I wanted to mention really quickly, that this is a little, the last sort of like bit of insight that I have that I think a lot of folks probably don't have unless they've been to Eastern Ukraine, is I see Eastern Ukraine described as like ideal for tank fighting and tank combat. Like people see this a lot. Oh, it's rolling hills and it's flat terrain. You know, people say this. It's like it's ideal for tanks. I think because of World War II. Like firstly, the terrain in the east of Ukraine is not the same as it was in World War II, because a lot of that shit's been mined out. The coal has been dug out of the earth and put into these giant hills. And so you have these huge ravines scratched throughout the earth. And it is, there are rolling hills, but going through it, every time I went out to the east, I never thought to myself like, oh, this is ideal for tanks, especially not in April and May. I thought to myself like, you know, man, this is like ideal for the defense. Like it'd be real easy to set up a defense here if you had time and you could fuck people up. And so, yeah, I mean, like the people who are saying tank combat, it's ideal for, you know, tanks because of some World War II fucking Nazi films or USSR films they saw. It isn't that way anymore. A, B, it's not World War II anymore. It's a new war.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the question I would have for you on that is, is there a mountain, an actual series, like a real mountain, well, I would say real, but a European mountain range out on the east. How about that?
There isn't. No. There's. It's. No. It's.
Not,
I mean, it's
not even
flat.
Like a. Not even like a coastal range.
I don't think so. I think. I mean, they're hills. They're hills. They're what's described as like rolling hills, and there's also plateaus, but no mountain range.
No. I mean, I always think of Europe on like Italy, close to the ocean. It's got hills. I would not say they're fun to be on if you're trying to. If you have to get up them. It's not a party, I would argue. There's a lot of steep escarpments and not a fun place. But fun place, but not a fun place if you're like, I need to get from the beach to the top. Not that kind of fun. All right, sir. Well, that's all I got. So let's go ahead and press stop recording for the moment.
If you like this episode, please rate, subscribe, and tell your friends.
My stuffies like this. They're gonna subscribe.